In September 2016, the esports world was rocked when it was announced that an ownership group called Axiomatic, led by Ted Leonsis of Monumental Sports and Entertainment, which owns the Washington Capitals and the Washington Wizards, and Peter Guber, co-owner of the Warriors, the Dodgers, and the forthcoming Los Angeles Football Club, had acquired a controlling interest in one of the biggest esports organizations in the world. Team Liquid. The man they brought on to run the ship, Bruce Stein, a consumer product and tech executive who has been CEO and COO of Mattel Toys, Sony Interactive Entertainment, Kenner Products, and a number of other businesses.
In this version of Esports Exchange, I speak with Bruce, as well as the VP of Monumental Sports Network, Zach Leonsis. We talk about the formation of Axiomatic, how they currently see the esports space, and what they're looking at going forward. It's a great chat. I thoroughly enjoyed talking to the guys. So without further ado, let's get to it. Gents, it's great to have you.
What's going on, Mike?
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome. Now, a three-man pod can be a little bit of a challenge, and we're going to make it more difficult on ourselves here by recording this from three remote locations. But I'm interested in getting the scoop on how Axiomatic came together. When did the topic of esports first come up between you and Peter?
Actually, it first came up on a plane ride when Peter, this would have been 2015, when Peter said to me, "Hey, what do you know about esports?" Because he knows that I've been looking at the influencer space for a number of years, and the influencer space as it relates to influencers putting up videos of themselves playing video games. And we'd looked at a couple businesses like that. And I told him I had made an offer on a small esports team that was in one game. And when he asked me about the audience and the size and what was driving it, and I gave him sort of a download on what some of the numbers were behind League of Legends and Counter-Strike and Dota, he was, you know, looking at it and saying, how do we make this bigger? And I said, well, there are teams that are composed of many games. That would be a better way to go, but I would need a broader group. And he said, look, I'm in. What should we do with this? And so we said, let's find some teams that we can look at that fit our spec of being in multiple games. And then let's also sit down and talk about who would be an ideal group. And right. we didn't even finish that conversation. He said, I got the ideal guy. And he started telling me about his relationship and admiration for Ted Leonsis through the NBA Board of Governors. And, you know, during that conversation, he gave me, you know, a 10,000-foot view of Monumental Sports. And when we looked at the business of esports, we felt from the beginning that a team ownership was a component of a strategy, but not the end of the strategy, and that we needed to build a sports enterprise to be able to have verticals in different areas beyond just a team. And in that regard, it seemed like Monumental Sports was, you know, almost, you know, letter perfect for what we needed in a strategic partner. And that's, gotcha. That's how it began.
I'll provide a little more color there, too. On our end, we were actively looking to make an investment in the esports space as well. And I think that Peter and Bruce and we were on parallel tracks, if you will. We had also had conversations with Team Liquid, and it wasn't until an NBA tech summit 2 years ago when we actually sat next to Bruce that through conversation, even though Peter was under NDA and couldn't discuss it, we knew he was talking to someone, and sure enough, it was the same team, and we were able to connect the dots, and pretty quickly after that, the formulation of the group came together. So we were definitely on parallel tracks to some degree, and it's a funny story looking back on it now, but the partnership between, you know, a West Coast group and an East Coast group is very symbiotic. We touched three out of the four major leagues, multiple venues, multiple media networks, And obviously, we've come to really enjoy working with Bruce, too. It's become a great partnership.
So it was at that meeting when the two paths sort of converged. You guys both realized that you were talking to basically the same team. And at that particular time, is that when you decided to align, or did things take some time to materialize?
Yeah. Things took some time to materialize after that, but it was pretty clear we were on each other's radar, and the two groups had strong affection for each other. So it didn't take too much longer after that.
And what was it about Team Liquid that you each respectively were captivated about?
Well, from my standpoint, relative to all of the other teams that we looked at, Team Liquid had diversity. It had 9 different games, 50 different athletes in those games, 10 analysts and coaches, general managers, and it was from our standpoint, a fairly comfortably diversified esport team that could expand into new games because the infrastructure was in place to be able to optimize those teams. So that was one piece. Two, they were a team that had a management group in Steve Aronsett and Victor Goossens. Victor began the team 15 years ago, and their legacy and what they built, not just in a team brand, but I think in a culture that players understood, was very attractive to us. And when we got together with them, and, as that is the group, Peter and Ted and Zach and the group from Team Liquid, who were, as Zach said, it was just coincidentally they were on the same path, we all sort of reached a conclusion that this was a group that we could work with relative to all the teams that we looked at, and that our efforts would be collaborative.
And you talked earlier about the ideal group, and obviously, the crux of that is Peter and Ted and Bruce. And then you obviously have built out, 30 or so senior sort of sports and entertainment executives and tech executives, Magic Johnson, Tony Robbins, Steve Case, Eric Lifkovsky. I mean, it's such an impressive list. Give me the download on how you approached those people and how long it took to actually form that team where you said, right, now this is the group that we want to use to make this purchase.
At the core of who got involved was one premise. We needed intellectual capital far more than we needed financial capital. Being able to build this financially was not a challenge initially. We knew that there was going to be more steps along the way, but the space was so hot that there were a tremendous number of people from professional sports and other endeavors that were investing in the space. What we did when we said, gee, who do we want to share this with? Because it's really more about sharing than, quote, looking for investors. We said, which people are in a business that's aligned that would have aptitude for businesses we want to create in esports? So, Tony Robbins was certainly somebody who knows coaching and inspiration. And NextVR was in a space that is a developing area for esports. Dick Clark has experience in live events. And Ted's group had, and Zach could speak also to, who else is in that group, but we, as you said up front, we have probably 7 different professional franchises and executives from all those franchises where we get to bring best practices. We're not imposing something from basketball or baseball or hockey into esports. We're looking for places where it can authentically be applied.
Yeah, I would say on our end, obviously, my dad has a long, long, wonderful history with Steve Case and Don Davis. They all worked at America Online way back when, and now they run Revolution Growth and Revolution Ventures together. And so they were sort of natural partners to go into this. We also included the likes of folks like Eric Lefkowski, who obviously gets e-commerce, digital sales coming from Groupon, one of the biggest e-commerce giants on the planet. And then we also included Tom Cartsotis, the CEO and founder of Shinola. hugely valuable touch points and experience in merchandising and brand management, too. And we even had a professional athlete in Dahani Jones join our group as well. So just like Bruce said, that diversity of thought was critically important here because, you know, I've heard multiple people describe esports as the Wild West. And, you know, the upside of all of that is that we really have a seat at the table now to sort of shape what does the formula look like for leagues and teams, and let's get the best minds from all these different touch points to help craft it.
Yeah, one thing I would add to that is, after doing this for some time, it was described as a Wild West, but I always thought in the Wild West you knew if you aligned yourself alongside a fast gunslinger, you had a chance to make it through a day. Here it's a little bit of chaos. Because you have a lot of people that are sort of shoot, ready, aim in different directions. And when we brought this group together, even in the case of bringing in the pro athletes like Magic Johnson, the interest is not, again, in capital or in a marquee name. It's in Magic's interest in saying, gee, I think that building esports within ethnic groups is something that needs to be done based on current demographics, and I'd be interested in participating in that. And I think we got that sort of participation and leaning forward into the group from all the investors.
That's tremendous. I had read that you guys were looking to target these upstart areas, whether it's areas like the growth around minorities or females playing in the game, and I think that that's a key white space for all of esports really to work hard on developing. Bruce, I'm curious to get your take on what you think the biggest challenge is going to be in terms of running an esports-focused investment group like this.
The categorization of esports as a sport is appropriate. These are people that are practicing, developing skills. They have tremendous peripheral vision. They're doing 300, 400 actions per minute. And it is a sport, but where it's different is in the economics, because the sport of baseball is really not owned by anybody, nor is basketball. And in these cases, in esports, publishers own a particular application of the sport. So interactive gaming is the sport, and the version of what sport it is, in this case, a game title, like CSGO or Dota or League of Legends. So that's different, and it presents a different challenge in terms of how you monetize the space for an enterprise. And we're at the very, very, very early stages of this entire trajectory of where esports is going. And I think the challenge is to run the team competitively in the short term, but also have your eye on the intermediate and longer term opportunities that I think ultimately will favor teams more than they do in the current environment.
And so just go through some of those opportunities. I mean, you guys have talked about building out, consumer products group, an intellectual property arm. Talk about the different white space that you see around esports and the opportunities that may or may not be there in the future.
Well, the consumer products group, we're not looking at becoming a company that's inventorying tremendous amounts of products and selling it through traditional channels. We're looking at a way to skim the cream off of a business where the opportunity, if you were to metric it against football expenses per capita or any other sport, the amount that the e-sport enthusiast is spending in ancillary purchases is probably fractional of what you would see in, let's just take the NFL, where the expenditures are far higher. If we were just to get to a level that was, say, half of the NFL, then that one aspect of the esport business would become about a $7 to $10 billion business. When people quote Newzoo numbers or other places and say the esport business is growing to $1 billion, they're not including publisher revenues, and they're not including a lot of elements we think are should be counted But if you just look at the one side alone of consumer products and you say, all we have to do is come close and be proximate to what other sports are spending for the enthusiasts, that alone is you know, going to triple and quadruple the size of the categories. So we have interest in looking at those vertical areas where we see enormous potential that nobody has touched, because the focus until now has been really on the players and the teams and not on building out the enterprises around it. So that's the reason we wanted to bring these groups together, because we need the input and we don't want to invent it all. We just want to take best practices. So I think that's going to change. One other area that we are right in the midst of right now, and I consider this to be an inflection point for esports, is the idea of franchising. Yep. So Blizzard announced that they were going to franchise Overwatch, and Overwatch has been a very successful game. It has 20 million active users, and yesterday I actually learned that their number's more like 30 in just a year. And, you know, that is going to change the business from being a sport where the teams compete in some kind of arbitrary ranking system or in a relegation system into a franchise spot. And we've, of course, been invited to participate in the franchise. And in this regard, it's, you know, this is a bullseye at 400 yards for our group. We have resources from Zach and his team and Peter and his team in being able to say, here's how leagues would form, here's how franchises can work. And in that mix, we think there's a lot of opportunities for teams. That's one of the biggest changes. And Riot, who owns League of Legends, has also indicated they're going to do a similar model, although the details haven't yet been announced, for League of Legends.
Right. So for the Overwatch League, the numbers that are being quoted for the franchise, they start at like 2 million, and they're saying it could go upwards to 15 million if it's an LA-based franchise. How do you value a franchise like that within esports?
It's a really good question, because there is some science and some art to it. The science is it's a new game. It's only been around not even quite a year since their debut last May. And if you just take existing ramp up of growth and you project it out, you would really be seduced by the enormous size of it. But it's hard to do that reliably. You don't know that a single title is going to continue to grow on the same trajectory that it's in over the first year. So what we have to do is look at it and say, and I think we're a unique group in terms of our ability to improvise on the model that Blizzard is offering. And as we've sort of done a pitch and catch with Blizzard on the kind of things we see as opportunities, I think it's expanded their horizon to look at the business more broadly than just saying, oh, you're going to have a franchise city, because it's great to be in a league where you own a spot. So that part's irrefutable. But the value of geography is harder to determine in esports, because it's ubiquitous. It's available 24/7. And that's something that requires, I think, real professional and live event experience to monetize that fully, which is, again, something that you just can look at the people in our group and say, you know, pound for pound, ounce for ounce, we probably can do it better than anybody else.
So not that you have to worry about it with Team Liquid being as big as they are, but curious here to get your thoughts on smaller teams, right, that are in the ecosystem right now but don't have the deep resources of like a Team Liquid. It seems like it'd be a worry for their sustainability. You think that's right?
Well, you know, you're asking a really important question that I think should be on the mind of publishers as well as teams. And that is, are you going to do everything? I mean, most businesses and new businesses, you know, have to be wary of cash flow and have to have focus. And certainly it's something that is on the top of our agenda. So as these prices get to a place where it's for some teams just not achievable, then they may be at a decision point where they have to make a decision. Do I want to be in that? Can I afford to be in that particular game? And I do think some people are going to be facing that. We're going to face it that way because I think each game has to be evaluated against its own metrics and looked at as a separate business. So we're not seduced, I think, by the noise of, oh my God, everybody's running for this franchise. We're more seduced by the ability of our resources in our group to monetize a particular game and space and to be able to work collaboratively with a publisher. Because if you can't do that, then it isn't going to work for anybody. But I think one thing that you'll see also evolving out of this is that a lot of the sales may be made to non-endemic teams. And that's sure. Partly a function of where the capital in other professional sports mm-hmm. exists. But either way, there's going to have to be a melding together of the esports expertise that exists now from endemic teams and the knowledge that most of these executives have and the capital from other places to be able to, you know, fully optimize a franchise opportunity.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting days for sure. I want to talk about China. So back in December, Axiomatic received an investment from Chinese investment company Puji Capital. And in this wild world of esports, China remains this very difficult but crucial region that everyone's trying to get to. So what part of this move, if any, was strategic for you guys, and how might Puji be able to help you guys expand in that region?
Look, the importance of the China leagues and the Korea leagues are significant. They're on top of everybody's mind because 60% of the audience for League of Legends is in China, and Korea is a dominant force in most esport games. So we're aware of that, and we're also aware that we're not an expert in every part of the world. So we look to find partners who can make our work more efficient in areas of the country, in areas of the globe, since esports is a global sport, where we're not on the ground. So having Puji Capital, which works with some of the biggest tycoon families in China, is a value to us. And they know that part of the world. But, you know, Zach can talk a little bit about their connections there because it's far more than just Puji Capital. Puji Capital is a group we've known. But fortunately, because of just experiences we've all had, either manufacturing in China for me for 25 years, and the work that Peter has done there and Ted has done there and Zach's group has done there, we think we have a lot of different ways that we can partner in that part of the world.
Sounds like a smart move to me, and I got to say the Axiomatic model is definitely a fascinating one. I think the whole esports space is quite captivated to see how you guys scale. So certainly best of luck there. Bruce and Zach, this has been great. Thanks so much for making it happen.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Anytime, guys. Listeners, if you've enjoyed the interview, be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes, and if you're feeling particularly benevolent, leave us a review. This has been another episode of Esports Exchange. We'll see you next week.